Choke points.
Let's go.
Airport edition.
Let's go.
Think opposite is, of course, the go-to move when heading to the airport in your car, but a massive construction project is underway that might make that less necessary. Here's Chris
again. Yeah, and the think opposite is really, as we talked about, that best option for getting to the upper and lower drives at the airport terminal. And again, just a reminder of what that is. It's when picking somebody up, head to the departures deck. When you're dropping off, use the arrivals. Go counter to the flow because you usually go there a lot faster. But if you've been to the airport recently, like I was yesterday picking up Tommy from Bozeman, you've likely noticed all the construction on the upper and lower drives just on that last little sweeping right-hand corner before you get to the up to the terminal. Workers are digging out the west sides of both approaches and installing two large retaining walls. It's part of a $79 million project to widen the road into the terminal. SEA, or Seattle International Airport, as we like to call it, Perry Cooper, says they are adding two new lanes to the incoming drive, widening it from four lanes to six lanes.
We're going
to
have two dedicated lanes just into the lower drive. We'll have one lane that'll be for all those courtesy shuttles that will go into the third floor of the garage. And then we'll have another lane that'll be added on the far outside that'll go straight into the airport garage.
If you're having trouble visualizing this, because it's kind of hard when you're just hearing it like that, it's up at mynorthwest.com. It's really all about reducing congestion into the terminal. So as you're coming in from the top, there are going to be six lanes now. Mm-hmm. Two lanes will go to the top deck, kind of like they do now. Two dedicated lanes to the bottom deck. And you may think, well, there are already two now. Well, no, because what they're going to do is they're going to create a third lane that's only going to be for ground transportation. So you'll have to pick your lane before you get around the corner. And then there's going to be one more lane to the far left that goes directly into the garage. So they're taking some of those shuttles and whatnot out of the mix for people driving in. And it also includes, right through all that construction, a new pullout area for the rental car shuttles just before the garage, where the passengers will eventually load and unload there.
That's going to be where the rental car facility buses will park, pick you up, and take you out to the rental car facility. So we take those large buses off the driveway on the lower drive and make it more available for regular cars.
There's also a matching pullout on the south end of the garage that's already in operation.
It will hopefully reduce the congestion that we especially see at night, say from like 8:30 evening flights. 70% of our flights are arrivals. Everybody's trying to get to that lower drive.
And it's the same thing going on for the off-site parking shuttles. You know, if those of you go find a spot somewhere on International, you take one of those shuttles in, they now go into the bottom floor of the garage. They're now going to go up to the third floor with all the cabs and the taxis and the Ubers and all of those things. So we're going to get them out of the mix there as well. So for airport managers, it's really all about squeezing some new capacity out of the tiny footprint that is this airport. So they're going to be moving the roads a few feet to the west. That's really the only way they could have done it for widening the road.
We got the light rail right there on the east side. How do you add a lane when they got the light rail right there? There's no space. So the only way we can do it is by shoving or creating a new retaining wall space to the west and then turning those into lanes coming up.
Same mantra for expanding the airport inside the terminal. Of course, as you know, there's no space to build out, so they're going to build up. This is not Denver, where you have unlimited land. You have likely noticed all the ongoing work near the Alaska Airlines check-in and all the work between the upper and lower floors. The airport is adding new check-in service there in those in-between spaces, and it's hard to miss the giant crane above the C concourse.
Another thing you might see as you come driving in is there's a huge construction crane up here, and that's actually the start of our C concourse expansion. So you typically don't see things that tall in the middle of an airfield because you've got things flying by.
The airport is adding four new floors to the concourse, nearly tripling the square footage of the C concourse. And of course, going up is really the only way to expand at the airport. This is all part of a $5 billion investment in improvements that are going to continue through 2026.
Wow. So there'll be gates on the second floor?
Well, not gate, but those individual check-in kiosks will be available there kind of on the same level as the walkways from the garage. So that in-between space, they're creating kiosks there. You'll be able to eventually print up your own boarding pass there and then put your own luggage into the system there and get your luggage tag and then go directly to security. They're also adding a new security checkpoint on the far south end where the international terminal baggage claim used to be, because now that baggage claim is inside. So they're doing what they can with their limited footprint, but that's what the construction is that you're seeing as you go to the airport today.
I just gave up on the drive last time I went. I stayed at the Hilton across the street, and you can just walk across the pedestrian bridge. If they put in some escalators and a moving walkway, you could drop people off across the street.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you could. And one thing that our good friend Heather Bosch, our coworker, likes, she's like, ask Perry Cooper why they didn't put the light rail closer. And he goes, we get that question a lot. Yeah. He goes, yeah, maybe if we did put in light rail 30 years ago when we first thought about it before they built the parking garage,
a little too late,
it would have come right in there, right next to the terminal. But there was a giant garage in the way. So that's why it is what it is. Yeah.
You can also say, why don't you just move the garage, 8 feet to the east?
Yeah, that would be easy to do, certainly.
Yeah. First, has got an update on the IRS with our tax whisperer, Kenneth Williams of CLA, because it turns out there is a whole lot of money being left on the table for taxpayers to claim. Here's Ken.
Yeah, the IRS announced recently that about $1 billion in refunds are left unclaimed from the year 2020. Of course, that was in the middle of COVID, and there were delayed filing deadlines, and people were dealing with a lot of other things. And the IRS estimates $1 billion of unclaimed refunds that are going to go away soon.
Now, why was 2020 such a special year for this?
Yeah, well, if you'll remember, so 2020 tax returns normally would have been due on April 15th of 2021, but because of COVID and all that was going on, they delayed the deadline until May 17th. And a lot of people were, they didn't have access to their documents. They were working from home. They couldn't contact their employer or whatever reasons. They just never bothered to file and then just kind of forgot about it.
I see. So because of the distraction of COVID, people just didn't file returns at all?
Yeah. And that happens a lot of times. Every year, there are a certain percentage of people that say, well, maybe I get $50 back. It's not worth the trouble. I'm just not going to file. And the IRS tries to follow up and send love notes saying, hey, we haven't received your tax return. But because of past budget cuts, they've been limited in their ability to follow up on that. And so a lot of these things just kind of go by the wayside. And the IRS could just say, well, fine, we'll just take the money. We'll just keep it.
Yeah.
But they're also interested in keeping people filing returns. We have this voluntary tax compliance system, and they rely on people filing a return every year. They don't want them to get out of the habit.
I thought that was a pretty serious thing, that if you forgot to file a tax return, regardless of whether you got a refund or not, the IRS would quickly send you a letter. But so they weren't enforcing it, and so people figured, oh, since I don't owe any money, the IRS is not going to come after me.
Yeah, they do send notices. They do follow up, particularly if it looks like there are substantial amounts of unreported income. But it's not a perfect system, and there's a lot that slipped through the net. And particularly during the tight budget cuts of the last decade, they haven't been able to follow up on those. Interestingly, they've also announced a new initiative with the new money that they got last year that they are they're following up on 125,000 unfiled returns for people with high income, the income that was reported to the IRS, but they never got, they never received a return. And so they're sending out 25,000 notices to people, high income earners, $1 million or more of reported income, saying, hey, we never got your return. So they're trying to close that gap, but there's still a lot that slips through the cracks. And or sometimes it takes 2 or 3 years for them to follow up and say, hey, we never got this return.
Yeah. So now they're trying to do a nice thing.
We've got this money. If you don't take care of this, we'll keep it. But they estimate about $1,000 per person on average of those who haven't filed, almost a million people who have not filed returns for 2020.
So are there people who figure, well, let's see, I did not file a return in 2020 and nobody said anything, so maybe I'll just stop filing returns?
There are those that would do that. I think my advice would be, I'm not sure that's a good idea, because the IRS is getting better at this. They're relying more on automated processes to track and follow up on these things, I think we're going to see a lot more notices than we have in the past for people that have not filed. If any income has been reported to the IRS, they're going to be looking for a tax return associated with that.
We're hearing from our tax whisperer, Kenneth Williams from CLA. And with all this unclaimed money just sitting there, is there a deadline by which the IRS just decides we're going to keep your money?
Normally, you have 3 years from the original due date to file a return and claim a refund. You can always file a return, but to get that refund, you have to file within 3 years of the original due date. Well, in 2021, the normal due date would have been April 15th, but because of COVID, they delayed it to May 17th. So the IRS is saying, look, you have about a week between now and May 17th of 2024 to still file a 2020 return and claim a refund if you're due a refund. So they're basically saying, look, if we don't get a return filed in the next week, we're keeping the money.
Now, what does that mean when they say they're keeping the money? Could they just spend it on hiring new auditors, for example?
Well, no, it doesn't. The IRS doesn't get to keep the money. That's a fair point. It's all part of the revenue that funds the government. So yeah, it's just that much more tax revenue that's available for the general spending.
That should reduce the annual deficit somewhat then, right? How much is it again that's unclaimed?
Just over $1 billion.
$1 billion. That strikes me as being substantial. It'd make a nice Powerball jackpot.
Yeah, and again, for some people, it may be a small amount. So maybe $50 or $100, but for others, it could be several thousand dollars that they're leaving on the table if they don't file.
You know, one of my pet ideas, which nobody's picked up on yet, is that the IRS should have an annual lottery where it just holds a drawing of all the people who filed accurate returns, right? So you would just draw a random taxpayer number out of the people who all filed accurate returns, and the winner gets that $1 billion that's left over, right, unclaimed refunds.
That would encourage
compliance, I think, and would make at least one taxpayer very happy with the IRS.
Yeah, it's maybe not quite as easy as buying a Powerball ticket, but
you're automatically entered, Ken. You're automatically entered if you file an accurate return. You don't have to pay in anything.
Now, it should be pointed out, a lot of people that are listening to this may say, oh, great, I'm going to go file my return. Be aware that you can no longer electronically file a return for 2020. So if you're going to do it, you're going to have to paper file that return. You have to print it out and mail it to the IRS. You know, your normal tax software packages can do that.
All right. And it's in your professional opinion, it's worthwhile to go ahead and get that money back.
Yeah, it's free money. It's your money. You might as well get it back.
Ken Williams, our tax whisperer from CLA. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Dave.
Your daily dose of kindness now brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. And I just think, wow, people like this really exist in the world. A group of friends in Richmond, Virginia say they really won the lottery when their friend Becky Durfee entered their lives.
Becky's one of those friends where if there's a way she can help you, she will jump right in.
I always think to myself, what would Becky do before I do anything?
They have nothing but admiration for how she lives her life.
I think that she's living the life and in a way that we all really, if we were living that way, it would be a better place.
Some examples of her big heart. Despite supporting two college-age children and her aging father, she still finds time to volunteer at an animal shelter.
I know there's such a need for fostering kittens, and you get them when they're at their cutest.
She also volunteers to feed the homeless.
And it's rewarding to talk to the people and hear their stories and see their faces and laugh with them and you know, they're people. They're people just going through a tough time.
And recently, she responded to the call for a kidney. She donated her kidney without hesitation.
Yes, I donated a kidney to my friend's brother. She sent out a Facebook message saying that her brother was going to die without a kidney, and I just recognize how blessed I am.
There she is. Her friends recently nominated her for an Acts of Kindness Award through the TV station this story came from, WWBT. And she was given that reward, a few $100, some gift cards. But mostly she says the reward is in the work she does. Yeah. She says if she sits down to watch TV, she feels like she's wasting time on Earth. That if she's here, she's got to be doing something to make the world a better place. So, Becky, you're a good person.
Indeed.
But right now, in an era of supposed gender equality, women in the workplace continue to face barriers. That's just the truth. Judy Carbone and Nancy Levitt are the authors of Fair Shake, Women in the Fight to Build a Just Economy. They'll be speaking tonight at Seattle Town Hall, and they join us now to broach this complicated topic. And June or Nancy, you can take this first question. We know what the data shows about wages between men and women. Women are paid far less, black and brown women even less than white women. But what's the reason?
Hi, this is Nancy Levitt. I'm a law professor from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and I'm here with June Carbone. When we began to look at the numbers, the gender wage gap, we found that for college graduates, the gender gap in wages was increasing. There was a 2019 Goldman Sachs study that showed if present trends continued, women would never catch up. We looked at the gender-based wage data and compared it to CEO salaries that have skyrocketed. 1950s, 1960s, the CEO to average worker pay was 20 to 1. The data for this year, a whopping, mind-blowing 399 to 1. And here's the heart of the book. The new economy celebrates those who can break the rules and get away with it. And so our answer to your question is, it's the WTA economy. Winner take all. Corporations have become extraction devices for their CEOs.
And so is this economy just inherently sexist then? What's the reason women continue to be paid less?
Well, that's the core of the book, is explaining the change in the internal dynamic of companies. So if you go back to the days of the organization man of the 50s, he could have been a woman. The critiques, loyal, collaborative, stayed with the same company for life, bragging rights. My company is bigger than your company. My company is more innovative than your company. Today, when you look at corporate pay, the transformation is the move to high-stakes bonus systems. The bragging rights as to how good a businessman Mitt Romney was when he ran for president, for his father, George, who ran for president in the 60s, as a businessman, it was the health of his company, American Motors. For Mitt Romney, it was the $200 million he had in the Cayman Islands. With the Wall Street Journal editorial pages saying if he were really a good businessman, he'd have more than $200 million in the Cayman Islands. You are worth the size of your bank account. Loyalty is a fool's errand.
So are you saying that women are just refusing to play that game and therefore they're paid less?
Yes.
Ah.
We call it a triple bind. Go ahead. What we discovered is that the practices that reward people who are pitted against each other in the workplace are linked to hostile, bullying, and sexist climates, and those are creating the gender disparities at work.
What is this triple bind you talk about in the book?
Sure. The first leg of the triple bind is if women don't compete on the same terms as men, they lose. They're not in the game. If women do compete on the same terms as men, they're
difficult.
Exactly. They're punished for their sharp
elbows. I know it well. I could write this book for you. It must have been a labor of love, really.
It has been. And it has been because we're able to counter what is conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom says women are given a lot of career advice, right? To lean in, to lean out, to be girl bosses. And we think the best advice is to change the system, not to change the women.
So are there any women who have made it to the top by, you know, competing as if they were men, and then once they're in control, they completely change the culture to something more healthy?
We are looking at, in the sort of solutions portion of the book, we look at the 10% of CEOs who are women. Yay and boo, right? It's up to 10%, but it's only 10%. Mm-hmm. They are outperforming their male peers. Companies with women executives are 30% more likely, according to a Forbes report of just a couple months ago, to outperform other companies. And this is confirmed by a NASDAQ report that gender diverse boards or audit committees are associated with more transparency, better reporting discipline, lower likelihood of manipulated earnings, lower likelihood of securities fraud. So women who get to the top executive ranks, and they do so by rising through the ranks typically, are ones who are promoting collaborative, nurturing, relationship building as the qualities of leadership. And those are the executives who are succeeding.
So then why aren't companies clamoring to hire women?
Well, we see what's happened most recently as a shift. So take finance, private equity, hedge funds, 97% white male and incredibly opaque in their practices. Big financial companies, publicly traded, the women in the upper management ranks have increased by 40%. Something similar is happening with tech startups, and the tech startups with women co-founders are doing better in a down tech economy.
It's incredible to hear. So you're speaking at Town Hall tonight. Is it a Q&A, a presentation of your book? How can people interact?
It's at the Elliott Bay Book Company, and it will be maybe 30 minutes of presentation and slides, and then questions and answers. Both of us are law professors, so we love questions and answers. It's kind of an occupational hazard for us.
And after that, we take on the world, right? That is June Carbone and Nancy Levitt, authors of Fair Shake, Women and the Fight to Build a Just Economy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And time for G. Scott, who's going to explain how your texting style betrays your age.
I understand completely, actually, after reading this article.
So, you know, usually the common question is, hey, how old are you? Now it's the new, hey, how old do you text, right? So here's what's happening. Let's get through it. Anyone right now, if you're using, when you get ready to text and you use swipe to text, you've probably seen somebody swipe, 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 do all those. It's most likely that you are a millennial that is born between 1981, probably 1986 on the whole swipe.
You keep your finger on the thing and just move around.
Oh, I've never done that.
I think it's called trackpad, basically.
I'm going to be honest with y'all.
I've seen it be done. I can't do it. Impress with those that can. All right, let's get to the next one. Texters who can type fast and accurately with one hand. You seen probably them little whippersnappers like bam, 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 with one hand.
You're calling me a whippersnapper.
Well, this is Gen Z folks. Usually those born between 1997 and 2012, they are really fast. You think you're fast, but these youngsters, they fast. You know what I mean?
You ever seen me text? You ever seen it?
Okay, I'm going to have to watch you.
Keeping up with my young peers.
So I just, now, if you haven't been triggered yet, then be prepared. I don't want you to be mad at me when you listen to what, this is the article. Don't blame the messenger.
Yeah.
Now, those typing accurately with both thumbs. So if you're a texter with your two thumbs, you're usually a millennial, Gen X, and maybe an early boomer, right? You're still hanging out with the thumbs a little bit. So that's you, Stelly. You still with two thumbs. Okay, don't worry.
Yeah.
It's gonna, later on in life, it's gonna change. Let me tell you how it's gonna change. It's gonna change with the, when you get into your 50s and everything like that, they start doing the thumb and the index finger. You know what I mean? Yes, the thumb thumb and the index finger. So you're if you're listening right now, you're about to text the show, G, quiet down, then you probably have a thumb and the index finger.
Okay, what? Two things. Arthritis and eyesight.
Okay. All right. Now, here is the final level. This is the final level right here. This is like, this is it right here. This is, you better show them love on Mother's Day this Sunday. This is, you better let them eat first at the dinner. This is everything. Okay, y'all ready? Here we go. Usually the elder baby boomers born between 1946 and 1964, you got your phone in one hand. In one hand. And you usually got your glasses at the tip of your nose. Right. And it's far away, and you got that one finger.
That's right.
I need you to call me back. Every time I text you, you don't answer your phone.
Why did you just describe Dave Ross?
You left out one thing, and then I spell check it and put in the right punctuation.
That's right.
Dave Ross will actually put a semicolon on text message.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So, again, if you are texting right now, and you're texting that, I'm sorry. At least I'm saying that you this Sunday should be taken care of, or any loved ones that, you know. So there's that. How old do you text?
I own it, and I'm not ashamed of it. Yes, I do the one finger thing. Because the swiping thing, the autocorrect, I've sent out so many stupid messages because of the stupid autocorrect. Mm-hmm. I just do it a letter at a time now until Apple comes up with something better.
Hey, Dave.
Yes.
You be proofreading your text, bruh.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
You put all the punctuation marks?
I put the punctuation. If it's a foreign language, I find the accent key and I put the right accent on it.
Oh, you do?
Like, resume has an accent aigu on the E.
So does the E in touche.
Yes.
Sully, that's 2 days in a row, bro. I don't know how you do
He's
that.
I don't call that texting old. I call it texting smart.
Okay, so that's all. So everybody's good now. I didn't trigger anyone.
No.
Would you? Is there anything that anybody disagrees with?
Nothing.
No. So,
other than Colleen. Colleen seems to say that she can text fast with one hand.
I have a caveat. I used to always text with one hand, and my husband would go, "How do you do that?" I can't explain it. This is going to sound really weird, but after I gave birth to my daughter, June, I started texting with two thumbs in the hospital. Mm. It's as if the trauma of birth switched how I text. I can't explain it. Mm. It's weird. I went from a one-hand texter to a two simply because I gave birth.
You guys know I always like to leave with a doozy, right?
Yeah.
When I get ready to get off the show. So I want to admit something to you. I know my wife's not listening because she's not listening yet, but whenever I know I've been on my phone too much and I can feel that stare from my wife, I use the left thumb and then my index finger to like, wait, so...
To make it look important.
Yeah.
We all do it.
I change the strategy. Like, hold on. Dave Ross wants to talk about this tomorrow?
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. Give me 1 second.
But see, you're y'all just scrolling social.
Life has officially become too complicated.
Yeah.
Thank you, G. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.